This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the founder and CEO of Metamaterial Technologies about a film that defends against laser strikes at aircraft. In the news, we look at a future where airlines pay you to fly, biometric facial recognition technology at the airport, the effect of climate change on aviation, a very close call at SFO, and odors in the cabin. All that and a lot more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 461 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian and he blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hello, everyone. Looking forward to a good show tonight. Let's get started. Wait a minute. Wrong show. Next.
Next is Brian Coleman, our associate producer, back from Germany, isn't it?
Yes, I was in Hamburg yesterday and here today, so I'm really happy to be on the show and looking forward to another good one.
Great. Also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert.
Thank you. I have just one thing to say to all of our listeners here in the United States. Call your congressman. We are running out of time on ATC yes. privatization. Stop the podcast. Pick up the phone. Go to govt.eaa.org. Do it today. There, I'm done.
You're good. That's good. We've been having a little bit of a conversation in our Slack team about this. I posted responses that I've been getting from my elected officials, and some others in the team have been chiming in with the reaction they've been receiving, which has been very interesting. A lot of it has been, well, some of it, I'll just say this, some of our elected officials have responded and said, we get so much email that sorry, I can't answer you right away, but hopefully I'll get around to it sometime. And others have been less than completely committed one way or another. So it's been very interesting, the responses we've been relating to each other in our Slack team. So yeah, absolutely. Write your elected officials. Go to that website. It makes it very easy to sort of automatically compose and send off an email. And I'd be interested in hearing the responses you get, too. Are you satisfied, not satisified with what you hear, whether you agree with it or not, or which side you're on? So,
but definitely do it this week. We are running out of time fast.
Yes.
And if you're obnoxious like me, you do it from all of your email addresses.
Oh, I love it. Good for you.
So I, of course, sent in my email to my Congress people, and it seemed like all of them out here took it as an opportunity to solicit money from me to contribute to the reelection campaign. And I found that most disappointing. It was just kind of a stock or a form letter in reply, just saying, you know, thanks for your support. We love hearing from you. By the way, you can give money to the campaign at xyz.com. Yes. And I'm like, really?
I think that's terrible. By the way, Brian, have I told you about my new Patreon page?
Okay. Let's move on. Yeah, this is the longest opening we've ever had. But
we're having fun.
Good, yeah, and a good reason to talk about this, too. So waiting patiently is our guest for this episode, and that's George Palikaris. Now, George is an entrepreneur, and he's founder and CEO of Metamaterial Technologies, Inc., or MTI. Now, MTI is a smart materials and photonics company, and they're working on some difficult problems that involve light, including the threat to pilots of laser strikes. Well, George was a postdoctoral researcher at Queen Mary University in London, working on wearable and implantable sensors projects. He founded Medical Wireless Sensing Limited, or MediWise. That's a research and development medtech company based in London. And in 2014, George received the Frost and Sullivan Global Aerospace Product Leadership Award for LambdaGuard MetaAir. This is a revolutionary new thin film that provides protection from laser strikes in the commercial aviation industry. So, George, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me to the show. I'm very excited to be amongst fellow airplane geeks.
Yes.
And looking forward to our show tonight.
Great. We're going to have a wonderful conversation about a technology that probably many of us know very little. And so we're really looking forward to that conversation. But we're going to start off, as always, with a little bit of the aviation news from the past week. So is everyone ready?
Ready.
Our first article comes from Business Insider. This is airline CEO predicts a future where, quote, we will pay you to fly. Interesting. Well, when he was asked about how low airline fares can go, WOW Air founder and CEO Skúli Mogensen told Business Insider, quote, I can see a day when we pay you to fly. Now, that's really an interesting kind of a statement. And the way I look at it is that, you know, in the old days, revenue stream used to come from ticket sales. And then as airfare prices have gone down, ancillary revenue accounts for an increasing share of revenue. Fees for services are something that we've grown accustomed to, I think, or at least we think that they're certainly here to stay. But the airlines do a number of other things. They have partnerships with hotels and car rental agencies, restaurants, and other travel industry players. So Mogensen is saying, in effect, that with all these other revenue streams and airfare really being such a small component in many cases of the total, that, you know, maybe they can become irrelevant. Maybe the airlines would even pay you to bring you into this fold. So what do you think, Max Trescott? Does this sound like an extrapolation that's somehow feasible?
I think it probably is. I flew WOW Airlines, a year and a half ago, and then later we had Skúli here on the show. In fact, I think he was the first airline CEO we ever interviewed here.
Yes.
His background is having run an internet company of some sort in Canada before he started the airline. So he's very, very much into the business models that are paying off on the internet. And if you look at a company like Facebook, for example, you know, we got 1 billion people on there. Nobody pays to be there. And anytime you're not paying for a service, you are the product. And so basically the reason we get Facebook for free is because we're looking at ads. I think Skúli's saying that model could apply to the airlines. I guess the question is, what are we going to have to endure on the airlines for a free flight? You know, are we going to be looking at nonstop TV monitors running in front of us? I mean, I shudder to think about that.
Yeah, and certainly all the other services as well. It seems like airlines are making just as much money, if not more money, on selling points to credit card and hotel companies. So, it's wide open as to who else they can be selling this information to. And Skúli was on episode 379.
Right. And it was a great guest. Interesting guy for sure. He's also quoted here as saying that WOW is looking at, quote, a deeper, more personalized relationship based on your prior behavior, needs, and obviously always with your privacy in mind. So, yeah, that sort of starts to sound like the Facebook model or the Google model, where they monetize, you know, your information, use your information and data to market things to you and so forth. So, George, I imagine that you do a fair amount of flying. I don't know how much of it is on low-cost carriers, but does this sound like something that could be in our future to you?
Well, I do have an opinion on that, and I've been, you know, reading the news as well as you guys, and I mean, you guys have another privilege. You're bringing CEOs and guys from industry that maybe can predict things. In my opinion, you know, I do fly quite a lot, and I do use a mixed bag of airlines and operators, depending where I go to. But I can tell you that if you're pulling on one side, I can see the other side doing something about it. For example, I was reading 2 days ago on the Times in the UK that air travelers can potentially be getting luxury flights without breaking the bank by what, you know, Wingly is doing. I don't know if you heard of this little company. They basically allow private pilots to add planned flights through a website and just a few days before takeoff. And, you know, you get Cessna planes and you get that Airbnb quality / you know, Uber experience from smaller aircrafts. And if we see this peer-to-peer kind of system that has disrupted the hotel industry, the taxi fare industry, you know, I have personally been in discussions with one of our partners, Airbus, and, you know, in January last year, they announced something similar with their helicopter division. So I see some interesting business models for sure being in development, and who knows which one will be the most exciting, and perhaps there'll be a number of them, and some people may love adverts and the ability to sit through, you know, infomercials through a very cheap flight may be appealing to some, and some others may want that more personalized experience.
And Wingly, I just read the other day, has about 3,000 users, I believe, in France alone. We had a company, at least one here in the U.S., FlightNow is the one that I remember. And they, of course, tried to make this work. But the FAA held that... Yeah, the FAA held that...
Vocal.
They said that when you interpret their Part 135 charter rules, this falls under those under rules. And they were supported in the courts. So for now, anyway, those kinds of ride-sharing type applications being flown by private pilots are against the law in the U.S. and aren't going to happen until something changes.
That's right.
You know, I think almost by coincidence, we kind of touched on some of these topics with the last PaxX podcast. Mary Kirby and I had our guest, John Norris, who is now the Senior Director of Corporate Sales and Marketing for Panasonic Avionics. And we talked about the Panasonic Next, NEXT, in-flight entertainment and connectivity system that they've been working on. This is something that's going to come out first with the Boeing 777X. And it's... You know, it's a platform. It's an ecosystem. They're going to have API capability so developers can write applications that dip into this, you know, this platform. One example that he mentioned was something like you could be sitting waiting to board your flight and to get onto your device, your phone or your tablet, dial up the airline and say, well, you know, on this flight, I want to watch this movie. And when you are in your seat and it's time to watch movies, there it is for you. But they're looking at ways they can, you know, bring this passenger experience to a new level based on information about you.
Does that mean that I will be able to load up my own Netflix account and watch my favorite series
perhaps
while I fly?
Yeah, perhaps. Especially if the airline can figure out how to, you know, make a little, you know, a few pennies off of you for doing that. So, yeah.
The data side alone, the bandwidth requirements, I mean, you can get some money out of that for sure.
Yeah, there's an opportunity there. But, you know, like you were saying, George, it feels like if there's ever been a time in the history of commercial aviation, let's say, where people have opportunities to introduce disruptive business models to this industry, it feels like now is the time. And so, yeah, maybe we'll see some interesting things coming down the line.
Yeah, Max, I still think that they're going to have to make the technology work, though, because on my flight back from Europe, there was a millennial who was sitting next to me and the Wi-Fi system wasn't really working. And she complained like crazy to the flight attendants over how incredibly bored she was and how terrible it was that she didn't have access to the internet.
Millennials can't survive without it.
It was just sad to, well, I was going to say it was hysterical, but nah, it really was sad that she could not sit still long enough and entertain herself because she did not have access to the internet.
Hmm. Wow. And I just flew out to Texas on Friday, and there were long periods of time when I just sat there and relaxed. it's kind of nice on an airliner just to kick back and be disconnected and unplugged.
Yeah, read a book, fall asleep. Yeah, or like David says, look out the window. All right, let's push.
I would never say that.
You've said that many, many times. All right, next item comes from APEX, the Airline Passenger Experience Association. This is Chicago O'Hare joins in deployment of biometric exit technology. Biometric facial recognition technology. It's been piloted at Atlanta International Airport. They did that last year. It's now been deployed at Washington Dulles and George Bush Intercontinental Airport. Now CBP, Customs and Border Protection, is bringing facial recognition biometric exit technology to Chicago O'Hare for selected flights. In its press release, CBP says, I'll quote them, using the flight manifest, CBP builds a flight-specific photo gallery using photographs from the travel documents the traveler provided to the airline. CBP then compares the live photo against the document photo in the gallery to ensure the traveler is the true bearer of the document. If the photo captured at boarding is matched to a U.S. passport, the traveler, having been confirmed as a U.S. citizen, is automatically determined to be out of scope for biometric exit purposes, and the photo is discarded after a short period of time. CBP remains committed to protecting the privacy of all travelers. So another technology at the airport, this one for exiting customers, I guess, coming into the country who are not U.S. citizens.
Yeah, Max, I'm really confused over this one. What problem are they trying to solve? I would see this as being something great for screening people coming into the country, but leaving? I just don't get it.
Well, that's true, because JetBlue is testing this biometrics for boarding at Logan International Airport. So, yeah, I'm not sure what the outbound side is looking to do. Maybe this is something, you know, on the outbound side works in conjunction with the security forces at the destination country. Don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I was confused by this one.
Yeah, it just seems that we get scope creep where they'll go further and further and gather more and more data until someone says, stop, you're not allowed to do that. But no one seems to be doing that.
Yeah, well, you can see the privacy issue would be applicable to anybody that's, you know, going through this kind of technology. But, you know, you see their reaction to the problem of privacy in the U.S. is to, you know, delete after some unspecified period of time. Wonder how long that is. Those who are found to be U.S. citizens. So, in this country, I think privacy for those from other countries where they might have stronger or different privacy laws, it just doesn't apply, while they are in the U.S.
Yeah, but you're already fingerprinted when you get your passport or go for global entry. So is facial recognition really that much more of an invasion of privacy?
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't see the benefit of screening people leaving the country. I don't see this as an invasion of privacy with facial recognition compared to fingerprinting. So,
how about for people coming into the country? Do you think it's a good idea?
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
No problem.
No, none whatsoever. Would love to see it implemented.
Okay. Next item. This comes actually to us via David in Augusta. This is from CityLab.com, Climate Change's Revenge on the Aviation Industry. This is information that comes from researchers at Columbia University and Virginia's Logistics Management Institute. And they modeled how aircraft departures would be affected by hotter days driven by climate change. I think the underlying thought here is that as temperature goes up, air density goes down, which means you get less lift. And if it gets really, really hot, you therefore get a really, really less lift, that something else has to give. Fewer people, less cargo on the plane, less fuel, and so forth. Max Trescott, I'm sure you know something can help us talk a little bit about how a temperature can affect aircraft.
Sure. So for the we're talking about jets here flying at the flight levels. The hotter the air, the more fuel you're going to burn. And don't ask me why that is. I just know that that is the relationship. I remember a few years back taking a Phenom 100 from California to Florida. And sometimes you can make it with just one stop. On this particular day, we had to make two stops because it was a little bit warmer than usual. So yeah, if your average temperature goes up, then your airlines over time are going to be, spending more money for gas, having their range, shortened, all those kinds of things. So yeah, it's going to hit them in the pocketbook, which means they're going to pass that cost along to us. So yeah, rising temperatures mean more expensive airline tickets.
And we saw an example of this kind of a problem with temperature recently in Phoenix, Arizona, didn't we? Where the temperature got up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit and some 40 flights or more than 40 flights, I guess, were affected by this and couldn't depart as a result of the high temperatures and the effect of that on the aircraft. I think it is a density issue, and there's different solutions. One is longer runway to build up the speed to generate the sufficient lift, but you just can't go out and extend runways.
Yes, especially at places like LaGuardia.
Exactly. But it turns out I see that different aircraft, different airliners have different maximum operating temperatures. There's an article in Wired magazine I found that says that the Bombardier CRJ airplanes have a maximum operating temperature of 118 degrees, whereas the larger aircraft from Airbus and Boeing can handle around 126 degrees Fahrenheit, I assume, temperatures. So the report, I think, goes into some worst case kinds of scenarios. Worst case meaning high levels of global warming. And that in a case like that, they see where maybe 10 to 30% of full airplanes would need to either wait for cooler temperatures or have to offload some weight. So pretty big impact. But it's an interesting story, I think. It's hard to tell, to evaluate all the assumptions that the study has made and, if... this is something that we really look forward to. Of course, there's a number of people that don't think that global warming is something we need to think about at all. But this is an aviation implication of that.
So what we're talking about here is potentially in the future, airports will have siesta time.
That's
they
good.
Shut down for a couple of hours and maybe they extend into the nighttime flying cooler.
More red-eye flights.
Yeah.
And I did essentially that with my trip to Texas. We were scheduled to bring that Cessna 206 back 3 weeks ago when it was supposed to be 113 in El Paso. It was going to be 116 in Scottsdale, 120 in Phoenix. And I just flat-out postponed the trip because our POH showed no data available above 40 degrees C, which is 104. And that's the reason that the regional jets are limited at 118. It's not that plane couldn't technically fly at above 118. It's just that there is no data available to the pilots as to what the settings should be for takeoff and reference speeds for landing and stuff like that, which then makes them a test pilot. And I can tell you, most pilots aren't interested in being a test pilot unless they're paid to be one.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, you guys are a conservative group.
Well, thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I mean, when you got something that could kill you, you really pay a lot of attention to it.
Yes.
Yep.
Well, speaking of which, we have a couple of articles here concerning the Air Canada plane that was coming in to land and started off doing so over a taxiway that had a number of aircraft waiting, full aircraft waiting, and disaster was avoided kind of late in the process here, and a go-around was executed. Go-arounds are not unusual, but this one was a little bit different. And, Max, I think that this one it was kind of a close call.
Oh, yeah, more than that. I've been really on top of this one because I covered it first briefly in my podcast last week, Aviation News Talk, and then I sent out a blog article to let people know about it. That got picked up by the Mercury News, which is the paper that had broken this story when they first learned of it. And since then, even more information has come out just in the last day or so. So I just sent the NBC crew away about an hour ago. They were over here filming for tonight's show. I mean, the latest information is that things were a lot closer than we first thought it was, and that's because FlightAware went back and they did some special analysis for the Mercury News, and they kind of plotted altitude data for, I'm not sure what the interval is, but I'd have to guess that it's probably on the order of every maybe tenth of a mile, something like that. So they have a lot of very accurate data as to exactly how high that Air Canada flight was as it went down the taxiway. And so the issue was that runway 28 left has been closed all summer for construction. And normally when pilots come into San Francisco at night, they're looking for two lit runways. And if you're told to land on 28 right, you pick the one that's, the lighted thing on the right. Well, lately, there has been no lights on 28 left. Normally, that wouldn't be a problem. You would just see 28 right because the taxiway lights are so dim. But to the right of 28 right is taxiway Charlie, which is normally not used. But because 28 left is closed, aircraft have been queuing up this summer on Charlie taxiway, and their lights created the impression that that taxiway was a runway. So the Air Canada pilot coming in saw two lit objects lined up with the one on the right, which in this case was the taxiway. What he did kind of question at one point as to whether or not there was anything on the runway. He said, I'm seeing lights on the runway. The tower said, nope, there's nothing on the runway. You're still clear to land 28 right. He continued on down. He had passed the beginning of the taxiway by over a quarter of a mile. He had already passed over a United Airlines jet. He was virtually on top of a second airliner, at which point he initiated his go-around, but only when people on the ground said, hey, he's lined up with a taxiway. And so the tower sent him around. He was at 106 feet above the taxiway when he initiated his go-around. He got as low as 81 feet while waiting for the engines to spool up. And that put him just 26 feet above the tail of the 787 that he was pointed at down the runway. So essentially, he was a quarter of a mile down the taxiway. A half mile in front of him, just about where he was supposed to land, was a 787 loaded up to go to Singapore, I believe. So yes, this was incredibly late. I cranked some numbers and calculated that if he had gone another 5 seconds, he would have been at the height of the tail of the 787. And if that aircraft were, not in exactly the wrong position, then in 10 seconds he would have touched down on the taxiway and then collided into either one or both airliners that were still in front of him. So, yeah, this was one of the situations which was way, way too close, and the day was saved because somebody spoke up. And I think so many potential accidents are avoided because either a pilot or a passenger or someone speaks up and goes, hey, this doesn't look right. And that's what happened here.
I think you mentioned on your podcast that the control tower is quite some distance from this location, correct? And so it kind of would be unreasonable for the tower to have observed that he was coming down on the taxiway. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. Visually, it's about a mile and almost a mile and a half from the tower to that point. And the angle is such that it would be really hard to tell that somebody was, a couple hundred yards further away from you and thus going to, land on the taxiway. The tower's not lined up so that you can look down the runways and down the taxiway. So, yeah, they would not have had any idea unless they happened to look at their surface radar. They have really excellent surface radar at San Francisco, and the resolution of that is such that they would have been able to tell that he was over the taxiway. But apparently the single controller in the tower was not referencing the radar at that time, and I don't think he's required to. So really it was all about the you know, the United captain sitting on the taxiway looking at lights coming right at him, speaking up and saying, hey, he's lined up for the taxiway.
Yeah, and Max, that was United flight number one, which I've actually been on to Singapore. And boy, this story scares the bejeebus out of me. So the other interesting thing about San Francisco Airport is the two runways are relatively close together, or actually, I guess by modern standards, really close together. And yes. I think having the taxiway so close as well, that could absolutely have contributed to this as an issue, just because normally the two runways are much closer than they are at other airports.
Yeah, I think that what happened here is the same thing that happens when pilots sometimes land at the wrong airport, and that's confirmation bias. You know, that this pilot saw some things which kind of led him to believe that maybe something wasn't right, but with confirmation bias, there's a tendency to trust information that confirms what we already believe and to discount information that goes against what we believe. So even though there were cues like the big red X that was over in front of 28 left, even though he initially said himself, hey, I see some lights down there that, you know, don't look right, somehow he still just kind of locked in on the taxiway and kept going.
And Max, that leads me to another question, is there's certainly the approach lights that extend out into the bay. Shouldn't he have noticed the lack of approach lights on the taxiway?
Exactly. That's why, like I said, there were many things that he could have spotted. For example, I communicated with a retired Air Canada pilot a few days ago just to find out if their procedures are similar to United. I talked to a United pilot about this. When they are cleared for the visual approach, which is, you know, basically means look out the window and land on that runway you see in front of them, the procedures for Air Canada say that you should back up that visual approach with electronic guidance in the cockpit that will take you to that runway. So often that's an ILS, where they also have the capability to generate an electronic path to the runway. Clearly, if they were following procedures, that information would have been displayed in the cockpit. And if it was, two pilots, you know, were not watching that. The United pilot I talked to said that once you're on the visual, the procedure is your eyes are inside, outside, inside, outside. So you're looking at the runway, and you're also confirming that the needles, you know, are indicating that you're headed toward the right runway.
It's probably really too early to speculate, but do you think this is going to result in some changed procedures or processes or something? Or do you think this is something that's going to be treated as, something that's specific to this flight, this pilot, or whatever?
You know, it makes me wonder if a better solution, rather than turning the lights off for 28 left, would have been to leave them on, you know, because that would have made it crystal clear. And the pilot would have lined up with the lights on the right. But no, other than that, I can't think of anything specific that they might, come up with.
Fill in some of the bay and widen the runways?
Oh, sure. Like that's going to happen.
Yeah. Never during my life. That's for sure.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. One final item. Reluctantly, from the Charlotte Observer, past gas forces passengers off plane at Raleigh Airport.
This is not a tanker story, right?
No, this is not a tanker story. And whether you call it, you know, passing gas or breaking wind or flatulence or whatever you want to call it, when I saw this, I was hoping this was fake news. And the International Business Times reported that on an American Airlines flight that there was a sick passenger who, quote, broke wind so violently it caused nausea and headaches among his fellow passengers. And then it cited a U.S. airport official as the source for this. There's also a quote here. The resulting smell was so noxious that fellow passengers became ill and were rushed off the flight. So my first reaction to this was, really? I mean, we've all encountered, you know, unfortunate situations where another individual has, you know, been a little gassy, but something that causes everyone, well, not about everyone, but causes a number of passengers to get sick and so forth. It just seems overstated. And in the end, it turns out it kind of was.
Yeah, I really thought this story came from The Onion.
It does have all the hallmarks of an Onion story, doesn't it?
It does.
So what was the upshot? What was the real problem?
Well, I guess they don't know what the real problem was, but they know it wasn't the passenger passing gas that, that was the problem. We see that in a follow-up story in the Charlotte Observer, the plane was not evacuated. I said a medical call came in for someone affected by an odor after the plane deplaned normally. This coming from a Raleigh airport official, and that there, I guess there was some kind of an odor on the plane from something detected, but not from the source originally described. So I guess we have our own little aviation. I don't know if you call this fake news or not, but
has anybody traveled to Malaysia before?
Uh-oh. Are we going to talk about the Malaysian diet?
No, I'm going to talk about the king of all fruit, the durian.
Yeah.
And on all the airport, there's signs, even on some of the airlines, the local airlines, where durian fruit are totally and absolutely not allowed in or the premises or anywhere near an aircraft. So talking about bad odor, one of those fruits can really change the flight experience for many.
I think I have heard of that. So I guess maybe that there's a new checklist item for travelers. Be careful what you eat.
Well, go ahead.
I just wanted to comment that I didn't comment about this story, Max.
I am totally shocked. We had some there were some comments on our Slack team, some of them very creative, concerning the story. It's really hard not to crack some jokes when you read this story.
Yeah, and if I were to try and connect the dots here, I would say this American Airlines flight might be the first one that Schooley Mogensen was talking about. Probably this was a free flight for everybody who was on board.
Maybe. All right, let's move on to our main topic. Again, we're speaking with George Pelikaris, founder and CEO of Metamaterial Technologies. Let's talk about laser light. George, when I think of lasers, what that means to me is coherent light. Is that what lasers are? Just sort of baseline everybody on what laser light is, and we can talk a little bit about the danger of lasers shining at aircraft.
Yeah, it is coherent light, and in fact, because it is coherent and it's monochromatic, so just a single wavelength, single color kind of type of light, it travels a long, long distance. It travels so far that our eyes cannot see where it ends, and it just keeps going until it basically dissipates its energy. But there are some tricks. You can actually use some special and basic optics to change the milliradian line and focus the beam at any distance that you wish. So there's a little bit of a myth behind the powerful lasers versus the not-so-powerful lasers. And I can tell you that even if you have a low-power laser, you can do a lot of damage if you know how to, let's say, use one.
So you mean if you think of lasers, they're used in meetings, laser pointers. Are those actually sufficient to impact the pilots in an airplane?
There have definitely been cases where that has happened, particularly green ones. You know, the human eye peaks at 555 nanometers, so that's right in the center of the green spectrum. And the green lasers are at 532, so they're very, very close. If you now add to that the dark adjustment, when the pilot flies at night, the pupils dilate between 3 to 7 millimeters, so that's 2 to 4 times more than daytime. And the fact that it's a green laser, it doesn't take much to have a flash blinding effect. Obviously, a low-power laser at a relatively close distance will not damage the retina, at least not permanently. And the startling effect, it's It's like being punched in the eye because your eyes are, you know, they have very sensitive nerves, optical nerves that get saturated with a signal, like that's a coherent light signal.
And so we've seen some different different reports, different studies about the effects of being struck by a laser like we're talking about here. Certainly, I think everybody agrees that there can be some momentary blindness. How long does that last, typically?
Yeah, so there are, the FAA classifies the concern in three different or three main visual interference hazards. Number one is the temporary flash blindness. It's like having a camera flash directly on your eyes, so the pilot is temporarily unable to see until, you know, the after image fades. And I'm sure all of us have been sometime, you know, having flashlights, taking just a normal photo. But sure, the difference is here, when it happens with green, the sensitivity of our eyes is, like I said, it's much, much larger. The second one is glare and disruption. So now the pilot cannot see past the light glare until the light stops. So that glare is bright enough to, you know, disrupt your normal operation, you know, like landing and taking off. And the third one is distraction. So this is now where the pilot is distracted by maybe some steady or flashing laser light. So it's significantly brighter than any other nighttime sources, whether it's your runway lights, you know, external kind of airport marker lights. So this is technically a visual interference. So the pilot not only can see the light, but he cannot basically use anything. Like, he may lose his mental awareness as well, become disoriented, etc. So that specific third one, you know, there's training, there's education. FAA has been proactive. But I can tell you that, you know, since 2016, we have seen more than 40,000 laser illuminations in just the U.S. and the U.K. Authorities reporting this issue. If you extrapolate that to a global scene, I mean, the numbers are staggering. And one of the things that I have learned recently is the fact that because the industry has not been very proactive in solving it, I mean, we have been trying and we're very close in getting our product certified. But I can tell you that, you know, pilots themselves are frustrated, and I've spoken to a few of them. They just, you know, are stopping reporting, and, you know, there's a lot of paperwork, and if it's not damaging enough, they'll just let it go. And unfortunately, this creates a false hope that something strange is happening and the numbers are down this year. But it comes in circle, in full circle, while all at the same time, laser power is increasing and the cost of owning a laser is decreasing. So these trends are kind of, the combination is quite important. And we may have all heard about some recent incidences. One, a Virgin Atlantic pilot had to go back to Heathrow after being lased with a red laser, a military grade laser. And earlier in, I think it was October 2015, where a British Airways pilot allegedly had retinal damage beyond repair and basically retired soon after the incident.
Yeah, terrible. Max T, do you have any experiences? I would think that general aviation might be less susceptible to this because, what, because less night flying maybe, but have you encountered any kind of laser strikes?
Boy, knock on wood, I have not, but I have friends who have. A lady who teaches flying at the same place I do sent a note out less than a month ago that she had been hit by a laser when she was 4,000 feet over the Tracy Airport, which is just in the Central Valley, about, maybe 30, 40 miles northeast of Silicon Valley. And we've also had helicopters, police helicopters, no less, here in San Jose, California, hit by lasers. Now, that is about That's about the most foolish thing you can do.
Ambulances have been reported in the past, including some more friendly media helicopters as well. So it is definitely expanding, and I can give you a couple of other cases beyond aviation, if I can. I don't know if you're aware, there was a game of hockey, ice hockey, in Boston, I think it was a couple of years ago, where the father of this women's team, 15-year-old girls playing ice hockey, was lazing the goalie so that he could influence the game. And then last year, there was some other incidences in NFL. In Europe, I mean, it's been in sports quite often, hooligans lazing basketball players when they take free throws. So it's definitely escalating. And the most recent incident was I can't remember the state. It could be California, where a woman was just driving her car 60 miles, 70 miles an hour, and somebody over a bridge lazed her and caused an accident. So she crashed and lived to tell the story.
Mm. This is terrible. Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know who's doing this. I don't know if these are, you know, kids or just, you know, irresponsible people that are unaware of the impact of this. I don't know.
Yeah, this is a great question, actually, and lots of time has been spent. I mean, the government in the United States, they have classified this, you know, Homeland Security gets involved in these attacks. So they consider them alongside terrorism, acts of terrorism. Other countries have, you know, very strong similar federal laws where people go to jail for 5 years, etc. But unlike a gun shot where you can trace the bullet to that gun and have hard evidence that that bullet was fired from that gun and the gunpowder, there's DNA evidence and et cetera, et cetera, you cannot trace a laser strike as well. So these crimes that go on are very difficult to defend for an attorney or for the state, on behalf of the state. So these guys, if they have good lawyers, they can easily escape the law. But one of the things, if you profile some of these, let's say, problematic areas, geographically, you'll see them agglomerating around very dense cities. And typically, you know, New York, the big cities, you know, in the south. And California is a big hotspot, Los Angeles especially. So there's relationships with economically deprived areas as well, especially around airports where, you know, things are, let's say, challenging. And, you know, the typical profile, I would say half of the people, potentially maybe a little bit more, are kids that, especially in the summertime, they don't have much else to do, and they start lazing the cat and the dog of the neighbor, and they start lazing, you know, the old lady, the neighbor next door, and then they start lazing something further, and eventually all the way to an aircraft. But there have been incidences and reports more rare where there were coordinated attacks, so two lasers aiming at the same aircraft from two different sides of the city. So that is beyond your typical, you know, kid.
Yes, for sure. Yes.
Good news is that it's more rare, and I feel that something has to be done about it, and we are at MTI trying to offer a physical solution.
Yeah, George, so without divulging any trade secrets, can you talk about how your product actually works?
Yeah. So the technology is a revolutionary film that is an optical filter that is adhesively applied on the inside of a cockpit glass or canopy. And it reflects a very small part of the wavelength spectrum. So you can choose what parts of the spectrum to reflect. In our case, we are protecting against red, green, and blue lasers. And statistically speaking, that covers more than 99.9% of attacks. The reason being that 95% of all attacks are happening with green lasers. Green being the most successful because our eyes are most sensitive to that color, as I mentioned. Our film is a nanostructured material. It's a smart material that, imagine that has hundreds of layers, nano thin, about 100 nanometers each. And each of these layers reflect a little bit of the spectrum out, like a mirror. You can strengthen the filtering effect or reduce it. But a couple of key benefits to the airlines are, number one, the peace of mind. You don't have pilots reaching out for, you know, putting anything on their eyes, etc., and recording that they had their eyewear put on at a certain altitude, the workload, the liability that comes with it. A lot of pilots, you know, if they don't wear, for example, some common solutions out there that are like laser eye protection, they would assume also the liability of having them on or off at certain parts of the flight. And typically, you know, just a human factor thing, you'd keep such a solution on your side of your chair until after you're lased. In our case, this film goes on the cockpit glass, and it is easy to install and can be upgraded. It's flexible so that it can be lightweight. And one of the big things that we're featuring in our technology is not only protects during the nighttime, but we are able to actually add some UV protection for daytime protection. There's been a lot of discussion with our partners at Airbus and pilots, and lots of pilots associations have stepped up, and they told us about this as a potential issue, whether we could add that as a feature, and we did. So we see ourselves as giving a 24/7 care for the flight crew.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, you mentioned Airbus. What's the relationship you've enjoyed with Airbus?
Yeah, so in 2014, we started doing some tests with Airbus. Airbus has been helping us accelerate this technology and our go-to-market plan. When it comes to security, the good news as a consumer, I can tell you that all the manufacturers, all the OEMs collaborate. So as a key message has been since day one from the Airbus chief innovation officer, his name is Jan Barbeau, that this technology would be available for all aircraft types. And today we're trying to bring this technology to the single aisle aircrafts initially, and then start, you know, expanding it will be an STC, a supplemental type certificate, onto different aircraft types. And Airbus has been kind to, you know, give us access to their A320 aircraft so we can do further tests and certify our product. They've been very strict, you know, with specification. I would say stricter than possibly the regulators if we had gone to them first. And now the regulators will soon become involved. So we're looking at FAA versus the European Aviation Safety Agency. They have treaties between them, so one kind of recognizes the other, and we're going to decide where we launch this first. And we're looking for some launching airlines. There's some interest there as well, small, medium, and large airlines that would like to feature this new technology in their cockpit.
I'm sitting here just dying to ask, will this make it down to the Cessna 172 someday, so when my friend is out flying, you know, she doesn't get hit?
Absolutely. Our goal is to be able to offer as much cover all the way down to Cessnas, to helicopters. And, you know, considering my earlier comment about this Uber model coming to, you know, the smaller aircraft, you know, we'll see more air traffic, maybe perhaps not at night, but in the evening hours, it'll still be risks that we can help mitigate.
George, is the product fully developed at this point, or is there more development work that needs to take place?
The development from a technology perspective has been completed. What we're doing is finalizing the design. So we are not at the design freeze, as it's called by the industry. This is happening over the next 2 to 3 months. And then we start the full qualification process. So we're really refining and fine-tuning the product features. For example, the UV protection feature was added this year. This was not on the roadmap before, and we had the capability to add it and respond to the need. So we are now at the point where we're just finalizing, and within the next few months we'll be qualifying. This qualification is about endurance. So when you put the film through the humidity, the temperature, the solar radiation, all those stories that you hear about, 120 degrees of
yes,
Arizona weather, the film should not fall off the windscreen. These are basic tests that, any part that goes on an aircraft has to go through. And we're excited because we know that our product is very high quality, and it's just a matter of time to go through the tests. We have done our own pre-tests, and I'm happy to report that, we haven't seen any roadblocks and showstoppers. And beyond that, it's a flight test with the partner airline, the launch, and then we will start the installation at the later part next year.
I was going to ask you about the process for installing this film. Is it as simple as peel off the backing and just stick it on the glass?
It's almost as easy. I wish it was easier, like, car window tinting. But we're trying to make it as easy as possible, so that maybe it's not a DIY job. You'd have to be qualified, and we're going to be working with MROs across the world, train them, and there'll be certified centers where you could go and fit the solution. There's a couple of tricks that you need to apply. For example, removing dust. This is an optical grade film, so any kind of, let's say if you haven't cleaned your cockpit for a while, you need to do that before you apply our film.
Maybe similar to the process of putting a screen on a protective screen on a tablet or a computer, yes, display, something like that. It needs to be very, very clean, and you have to have good technique so that there are no remaining bubbles and things like that. I imagine it's kind of similar.
It's a matter of exactly. It's a matter of having the right tools and the right cleaning materials. So even, using a solvent inside the cockpit has to be approved. So there's always restrictions, which, are there for a reason, for everybody's protection. And as a result, we need to do it step by step. And we are working hard to make sure that this technology becomes available.
So, George, instead of having the product applied after the fact, can you see this evolving to a point where during the glass manufacture, it's either incorporated or be put in between two layers of glass, so you don't have to worry about the maintenance piece of it?
Yeah, excellent question. So we have been approached, and we have been speaking to all the glass manufacturers since the beginning, more with some, less with others. But the clear message is this is basically going in every cockpit and installing it, maybe as a check B. So it's not at the gate, it's, within a month, let's say, when the plane goes to do its normal servicing. But beyond that, if you start looking at putting the film in the glass, well, there is a problem. If the thread changes, and my prediction is that this laser thread will evolve. I mentioned that the statistics show today 95-94% green laser strikes as being the issue. But as the threat evolves and maybe different colors become a thing, the ability to upgrade and change the film would be important. So putting it in the glass would be very disruptive, because when you change the whole windscreen, the cabin has to become rechecked for cabin pressure. So on the ground before you take off, they would have to do a very expensive test and power up, do the whole thing. Cabin, you know, pressure is on to see if there is any leaks, because you're resealing the whole window. And there's like something about like 1,000 screws. So nobody wants to take off and put on new windows all the time unless they really, really, really have to.
Sure. George, are you able to talk about the pricing of this at this point, or is it too soon?
So regarding the pricing is something that I can't talk about right now. One of the things that we announced last month at the Paris Air Show was a sales and distribution partnership with Satair. So Satair is a global kind of logistics parts company that has been keeping, you know, a lot of operators flying with thousands of parts. So we are together working on a sales strategy where we want the best value for the customer. We just want to focus on our side solving the issue, and our partners at Satair will make sure that this is economical and fair value for the operators, all the way down to the smaller operators and the DIY and private kind of owners in general aviation.
I'm curious, would it be practical to do goggles, you know, for a lower cost, so that if someone were flying an unequipped aircraft, they could wear those goggles? I'm guessing that that would protect the eyes, but you might still see a lot of flash on the windshield.
So you would. So the eye protection has been around. There's many eyewear companies that have been selling laboratory type of eyeglasses and kind of tried to put some on the market for aviation. In our experience and the feedback that we're getting from pilots is that they quickly go on the side of the chair. So it's just a human thing and human nature thing. So unless, you know, on the general aviation, you really want the protection, you can go and, you know, you can purchase some of these solutions that are out there. But how do you choose the right solution? And how do you train yourself to adjust, because these eyewear cut a lot of the light. They're not as transparent. And when you put them on and you look at your instruments, potential risks there, you know, losing some of the colors of your instruments. So if you take out the green spectrum, everything looks orange. And, you know, if you take out the blue, everything looks green, and so on and so on and so forth. So in your intuitive perception of your instruments will change, and that's really a risk that each pilot needs to be aware. At the same time, your Scott optic vision will change, so your night adjustment. Whenever you put even just reading glasses, your pupils will dilate less. So for pilots that have, you know, 20/20 vision and they're used to not wearing anything but maybe their Ray-Ban sunglasses, this will be a challenge again, and the peripheral vision changes as well. It reduces from, you know, your 160 to 180 degrees to down to 120. So now you have to learn how to turn your head while you're making certain things happen. So there are that kind of the more practical reasons, and then the more on the liability side, I feel that pilots would take on liability if they did something wrong. They could risk insurance claims either against them or potentially, you know, if they were going for something, let's say was damaged and they were trying to claim something, it could be a domino effect of things. So we believe the ultimate reason is that you don't get UV protection. So so if you want nighttime and daytime protection, I feel that, you know, Meta Air, our technology, our product, will by far give a fantastic advantage to a pilot and the crew.
A fascinating conversation, George. It's a topic that's important. I think we'd all like to hope that there would be a way to prevent people from lazing aircraft, but I don't think that's going to happen. So a defensive strategy is what's required. And it's really great to hear about that strategy that you are working on. George, tell our listeners where they can learn more about MetaAir and MTI in general.
So the best place is to go through our website, which is www.meta, so M-E-T-A, material, one word, so metamaterial.com.
Great. And of course, I think we'll be watching for the press releases, the news of the progress that you're making at MTI and how that product becomes a reality and begins to find its way into aircraft. Very exciting. So again, thank you for coming on the Airplane Geeks podcast and explaining all of this to us and our listeners.
Well, thanks for having me, and looking forward to hearing the rest of the show.
Yeah, George, this is really exciting to me, yeah, having friends who've been struck by lasers. So if you get to the point where you're looking for some Cessna 172s to test this, please let me know. No, I'm serious. Please let me know. We'd love to test it.
I appreciate it. I'll keep you posted.
Hey, Max, I had one more question for George.
You always have one more question.
I know.
After we finish, you have one more question. This is like the famous last one more question from Brian.
No, because there's never a time to interject in the middle of the show. It's always such great conversation. I never want to interrupt.
Maybe in the future, okay. I should say, okay, now here's the one more question from Brian.
Okay, Columbo, go ahead.
So, George, in addition to doing your film for laser protection, what other materials are you working on?
Yeah, so our company's all about mastering light. So we do this by blocking light. So in the case of laser protection, we're deflecting it. But we can do the exact opposite, to absorb a lot of light. And I mean a lot in the sense of increasing solar efficiency. And we have a very interesting application for aviation, which is the world's thinnest solar cell that is very suitable for flight. So we are very excited to be working with the likes of Lockheed Martin on this project, where we are going to be testing potential hybrid solar cell for energy solution as a power source for HVAC. So when those really hot summer days come, and, you know, not so hot either, the HVAC system, the entertainment system, and a few other onboard systems can be run purely on solar power. We calculated that on the back of a 737, this is the fuselage portion, or a Airbus A320, we would be able to generate between 50 to 100 kilowatts of power per hour. And that translates to about 1 to 2% of fuel efficiency for a passenger aircraft every year. And that in turn translates into hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of fuel saving and a few tons of CO2 emissions reduced. So we're very excited about that project. And the technology has been in collaboration with Stanford University, Caltech, and a couple of other industry partners. We still have a long way to go. It's still in pretty much R&D mode. And one of the components that goes into this solar cell, it's called NanoWeb. It's a electric, transparent, metallic layer that has some very even other interesting applications that go beyond solar, for example, EMI shielding, anti-ice capabilities that we are currently also exploring with test partners.
Hmm. When we talk about a meta material, is that really kind of defined as something that uses, a mixture of materials that create some property or properties that don't occur naturally? Is that how you define metamaterial?
Yes, extremely accurate, actually. So the word meta is to, that means to go beyond. It comes from the Greek word to go beyond. Now, metamaterials are nanocomposites. So they're structures that are made up of real life materials like metals and plastics. But when you pattern them, when you arrange them in unique ways, you're able to then, at the macroscopic level, change how light refracts through them. So as a result, you are able to absorb light, enhance light, bend light. And one of the most famous applications that made metamaterials the scientific field famous was the Harry Potter cloak, where a professor at Imperial College basically showed that it was physically possible to bend light and reconstruct it, you know, behind an object. So millions of dollars have been invested in stealth technology, and metamaterials had a big role to play back in year 2000, 2005. And since then, you know, we are trying to create science fact out of science fiction.
So we can expect to all have our own invisibility cloaks soon?
Not so soon, you know, you never know. If you start working on a project, you never know what else can stem out of it. So it's exciting times for science. And, you know, some of the metamaterial scientists have been rewriting the books of physics, literally speaking.
I've read a lot of Harry Potter to my kids, so I'm looking forward to the cloak.
All right, now let's do a little bit of a quick What's Up With The Geeks. David, I understand you've got a new toy.
I do have a new toy. I got a new camera. I got a new Nikon. I don't want to hear all the Canon people complain. D3400. I went out and played over the weekend. Went to a couple of museums with my friend Dave in Jersey, the Air Victory Museum, which is in the middle of the state. And we drove down to Cape May to Naval Air Station Wildwood, and I played with my new toy. A couple of pictures in the will be in the show notes, and of course we'll keep posting them. If you follow Instagram, if you know how to spell Vanderhoof, you can find me on Instagram. So I'll be posting them up on a daily basis, one or two photographs. So it was a really good time. I like taking pictures of airplanes. I tried to listen to our conversation, and I heard it in the back of my mind that airplanes should have people around them. So I was trying to learn to take pictures of having people ruin my perfectly good shot of an airplane.
Yeah, David, I'm with you on that one. So, yeah, you're fine.
There's no people in any of these pictures you've got here.
Well, I didn't say I just gave airplanes. You the ones. Well, there's a lot of clutter in them also.
No, nice shots. These are nice photos, and we'll put these in the show notes for sure.
And the other thing was, I got two new books from Schiffer, so I hope to do some book reviews coming up.
Oh, good, good. All right, Max Trescott, you brought the Cessna 206 back from El Paso.
I am back. Yes, so that was a really great trip. It was clear skies the entire way, and departing El Paso in the morning, we saw a C-130 spooling up and getting ready to head out, and we taxied by NASA's Super Guppy, which I didn't even realize was based in El Paso. So that was great fun. Our first stop was in Scottsdale, Arizona, and while I was sitting there, waiting, the Breitling DC-3 kind of did a U-turn in the FBO where we were at. We later saw him on the other side of the runway at a different FBO. So I'm not saying he got lost, but the world tour may have ended up at the wrong FBO in Scottsdale, but it was fun just shooting video of him as he came in, did a U-turn, and headed back out. So they're more than halfway around the world. I think they started in Europe. They've come across the Pacific, and now they're starting to work their way across the southern United States. And then the bad news was we had, I think, the first Cirrus fatal crash of the year, and it occurred here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And unfortunately, I know people who know the pilot, so that's kind of tough. That was one of those cases where we don't know for sure, but it appears that he pulled the parachute at too low an altitude. So parachute works great if you deploy it up above 500 feet or so, but man, you do it too low, and it's just not going to make things any better, probably make things worse. So that was kind of a mental low for us, when many of us in the Cirrus community, when that happened last week.
Right. All right. And Brian, you're back from your fast trip to Germany. What airline did you fly on?
Oh, believe it or not, I flew on United. And Rob will be very upset that absolutely nothing went wrong on my flight. flight crew did a really good job taking care of me. There was an issue with the inbound flight to Los Angeles that caused me to, or would have caused me to misconnect in Chicago, but the people in the club took care of me, rerouted me through San Francisco, so I got to Germany on time, all safe and sound, and it was just fine. So absolutely nothing going on there, and I'm getting ready to, or I'm still in the process of getting ready to do my trip to South Africa. And still, if we have any listeners in Cape Town or Johannesburg that want to do a Airplane Geeks meetup, quite happy to dedicate some time to reach out to our South African listeners. So,
and when is that trip again?
I leave August 23rd, so I get to Cape Town on the 25th. I'll be in Cape Town for a week, and then I'll spend a few days at the Game Reserve, and I think September 9th and 10th, I'll be in Johannesburg before I go to Kruger National Park.
Hmm. All right, great. I have nothing aviation-related that's been going on. Dramatic news is I was forced to kill a 5-foot rat snake this morning that was invading the castle. A very unpleasant experience, to say the least, but not at all aviation related. We do have one item that we've been trying to get on the show. We've been trying to mention this for a couple of episodes, but we keep running long, but we're not going to wait any longer. This is about the Dorkfest. Brian, you want to tell us about this one?
Yeah, so I first saw this where David Parker Brown posted it, and I guess Brett Schneider, the guy behind Cranky Flyers, putting together a meetup at a nice local airplane or plane spotting park at LAX, which is right across the street from the In-N-Out Burger. So if anyone is familiar with Sepulveda and 92 or 92nd Street, that's where it's going to be. And so it's September 23rd between 11 and 1. And it's an informal meetup. I am planning on being there, assuming I'm in town, and I'm trying to clear my schedule, so I will be in town. And I just think that it's a really cool area. The park is right underneath the runway. And I think having a whole bunch of like-minded aviation people will be really fun. So looking forward to that event.
It sounds like it's going to be really fantastic. And of course, you can find this event over at avgeekfests.com, as well as many others. And as always, we'll ask that if you are aware of something going on in your area where fellow avgeeks might congregate and have a great time together, head on over to avgeekfests.com and enter it into that aviation calendar. We'd really appreciate it. All right, moving on to just a little bit of listener mail. The first one, actually, this isn't from email. This is from Errol in our Slack team. And last time we talked about, watching aerial tankers at air shows actually hooking up. And as Errol said, and as David spoke to me about earlier, that this is something actually that's happened a number of times. So we have this YouTube video. This is A4K Kiwi Red plugged in barrel roll formation swan. David, doing a barrel roll while you're hooked up to a tanker, that just seems to me like insanity. Maybe it's just pure skill.
Okay, well, and I'm going to rely on it. It actually is only a 1G maneuver. Huh. You can pour iced tea doing a barrel roll, but that being said, being plugged into a long cord and being only about 20 feet behind the aircraft in front of you, it takes some really good timing to complete a complete barrel roll. And the Kiwis did it always with their air shows, with their Skyhawks. So it was always a good thing. I will say to Errol that while they were plugged in, he said they were passing fuel, and I don't believe they actually were passing fuel, because I don't think the buddy tank was capable of doing an inverted, passing the liquid inverted. One of the things A-Force had in when they became Blue Angels were they needed inverted flight tanks, which means that the fuel tanks in the wings could pump the fuel if the aircraft was inverted for any length of time. So I don't think a buddy pack qualifies for that. But to answer the other questions, I have seen plugged in at Naval Air Station Oceana. They do a Super Hornet refueling another Super Hornet. They have done A6s refueling A4s over the years and A7s. I have seen KC-135 plugged in to other aircrafts, as well as them flying in formation where they weren't plugged in. One of the things I told Max about the other night when we were talking about this was one of the most dramatic events was a KC-130 of the United States Marine Corps that was refueling a CV-22 Osprey over the Marine Corps Air Station Miramar Air Show, and the Osprey broke the line, and the drogue and the line fell to the ground in the middle of the air show in someone's backyard.
Ouch.
So there are some things that can go wrong, but overall, it's not uncommon if you have tankers around that you're going to see somebody plugged in during an air show.
Something that you just said that kind of surprised me. I had, in my ignorance, it seems, always assumed that gas came always from a tanker. But you're talking about that not always being the case in terms of one aircraft refueling another.
The Navy and the Air Force and the Marines and foreign nations, McDonnell Douglas created something called a buddy pack, a DB-502, which looks like a fuel tank, but it has a drogue that goes out the back. For most part in the Navy, and this is how our future drone refuelers are going to work, the Navy had KA-60s, which were converted attack aircraft, where they built the drogue into the fuselage. But the Navy also had Skyhawks could refuel each other by this buddy pack, which sort of looks like a modified tanker that plugs into the aircraft so the other aircraft can refuel aircraft. Now, that only works with aircraft that work on a probe and drogue. There are no F-15s and F-16s that fly with boom receptacles so that they can be refueled. They can't be refueled by other aircraft. People like the Israelis took Phantoms, which were Air Force Phantoms that didn't have a probe and drogue and actually had a boom receptacle. They built probes that went into the refueling receptacle so they could do air-to-air refueling with buddy packs. But overall, you can have a lot of things that are tankers. But KC-135s have drogues out on the wings as well as a boom. KC-10s have a drogue next to the boom. And our new KC-46 will have a boom, a pair of drogues in the fuselage, and a pair out on the wings. So it all depends upon how you want your gas. We just preferably you keep it from the cabin and you passing it from airplane to airplane and not in it.
Right.
To hark back to the original story.
Yes, yes. I got that, yeah. One last question. What's the refueling arrangement on the F-35?
Yes. Oh. The answer to the question is the Navy does, the Air Force does probe and drogue. I mean, the Air Force has a boom receptacle on the F-35A. The F-35B can't have a refueling receptacle up there because it's got a giant box for a fan. So it has a probe and drogue. And likewise, the F-35C, which is the other naval aircraft, also has a probe and drogue.
Hmm. Okay.
A probe.
All right. Thanks, David. Back to listener mail, and we'll close this out in just a second. But one last piece of feedback we got. This is from Alexis David Fafard. He writes us in response to last week's episode where we talked to Dan Pimentel about being an aviation writer. And he says that he's a policy advisor for a Canadian senator. He's also a flight student at Ottawa Aviation Services. And he's complimenting us on having Dan on the show. He says his experience and views on aviation freelancing were simply great. And Alexis reports that he's actually started to freelance himself and write articles on policy and legal issues in Canadian aviation, and that a European aviation news website, aerotime.aero, has actually started to publish his articles. So we have a link to one of those articles. It's titled Foreign Ownership, a New Ident for Canadian Airlines. And we'll put that in the show notes. So that's great. If any of you listening have also been inspired to write aviation-related articles for publications or other websites, different organizations and such, feel free to let us know. Tell us what you've written. Maybe we'll give you a little bit of promotion, but it'd be fun to kind of hear from you how many of you have actually been publishing some articles. And I'm thinking about the more kind of, you know, fresh writers, not like Max Trescott, who's been writing articles for, I don't know, how, when was your first article published, Max? Do you even remember? It's been so long.
Oh, dear. You know, I used to write some stuff when I was at Hewlett-Packard years ago. I think one of the first articles I remember publishing was for QST Magazine, Ham Radio, back in 1991. And I got the cover plaque as the best article in the magazine. So that still hangs up in my office. So that's kind of fun. Yeah, so I've been writing for a long time. And, you know, I did read Alex David's article that you just referenced. And he talks about how Canadian airlines are restricted to just 25% foreign ownership, which is a lot less than many other countries, and they're looking at possibly changing that. And totally unrelated, I don't know if we've talked about this, but up in Canada, they're currently studying whether or not to privatize their 26 busiest airports in the country.
Yes.
So there's just all kinds of stuff which is under discussion there with our neighbors to the north.
And Max, I think this is pretty fantastic. Not only do we enable people to start other podcasts, we have inspired people to start flying. And next week, I have a recording from a listener that's going to talk about their journey and getting involved in aviation and becoming a pilot. We're also inspiring people to become writers. So
cool, huh?
Yay to us.
Yeah, well, that's the best part of the whole show, in my view, is you know, inspiring people to expand and explore their passion for aviation. All right, well, with that, we're going to bring this episode to a close. We want to thank our guest, George Palikaris, founder and CEO of MTI, Metamaterial Technologies Incorporated. George, again, tell our listeners where they can learn more.
You can learn more about our solutions on www.meta.com.
Very good. Thanks again, George, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, they're at airplanegeeks.com/461. You'll find links on our website to all the places we hang out on social media, how to write to us, and all of that. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
I'm going to switch it up today, and I'm going to say, if you can spell David_Vanderhoof, you can go on Instagram and you can see more pictures of my little photo adventure as well as the food stylings that I like. It's food and airplanes, folks. That's pretty much everything on my Instagram feed.
And are there people in those pictures as well?
Sometimes there are, yes.
Okay.
A lot of times the pictures are of me as the people, but that's the exception to the rule.
That works, too.
And, of course, you can find me on Fridays on the UAV Digest with Max Flight. And I'm looking forward to this week because we're going to be interviewing the manager of the Oregon test centers, or the West Coast test center. So I'm looking forward to that.
Very good. In Max Trescott, where do we find you online?
Well, you can find me between the pages of Flying Magazine and anything with Jetwine in the name. Oh, wait, that's Rob Mark.
That's the other guy.
Where is he anyway?
Well, you know what? And the worst part about it was I was hearing it and I knew it was wrong, but I couldn't figure out what was the wrong.
That's so funny.
Rob's making a video someplace. Actually.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, we miss him, so I just wanted to get his plug in there. Yes, so I'm kind of grinning and smiling. Let me see if I can get back to a straight face here. You can find me at aviationnewstalk.com. And if you want to send me an email, you just click on contacts there. And last week on the podcast, we had a bonus episode on the Beechcraft Bonanza. So if you want to know everything there is about Beechcraft, you can check out that episode.
Nice. Brian Coleman, how do we reach you?
Oh, the best place to get a hold of me is send an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at the PaxX Podcast. That's at PaxXPodcast.com. I think you might enjoy the episode that just came out a few days ago. Check that out. You can also find me hanging out at the Airplane Geeks Slack team. You can learn more about that at airplanegeeks.com/team. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone, a really nice guy, and you can find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.